across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Good morning, it's Holly here for the remainder of this week in for Stephen. And we were getting into the nitty-gritty of it all this morning. As you might know, Monday did bring a programme for government. And now Stormont's finance minister has confirmed that she is planning to change the rates, which means our bills inevitably will go up. It could see some households and businesses paying a lot more. So it could mean raising the cap, for example. That cap currently stands at £400,000. There are a number of other proposals too, which she describes, the finance minister, Caoimhe Archibald, as a progressive rate system. So that effectively is another way of saying that the better off households will be paying more. Your thoughts on that? We also spoke to the Alliance's Saoirse Eastwood and Gregory Campbell of DUP and asked them what their priorities should be or would be, as well, of course, as the reaction to the cut to the winter fuel payment to pensioners. That's all happened now. We also chatted about this statue of Queen Elizabeth II at Antrim Castle Gardens. Not sure if you've seen it in person or on social media. It has received mixed reviews, shall we say. If you haven't seen it yet, we have posted a picture on our socials, I think. So yeah, not everyone is a fan. Is it that bad? What do you make of it? And finally, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, they finally met in person during a TV debate last night. Personal shots stealing the headlines, I think it's fair to say, as well as a certain Taylor Swift who's come out and endorsed Kamala Harris. We will be back here tomorrow at 9 o'clock. In the meantime, nolan@bbc.co.uk if you've got anything you want to get off your chest or any stories, and have a great day. See you then. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning, Holly Hamilton here with you in for Stephen. It's been a while. It was definitely a few degrees warmer last time I sat in this seat, but I'm okay with it. I'm fine. I'm sort of leaning into autumn now. I mean, it is the 11th of September. I've even got my autumn decor up. I know. I've turned into one of those people now, but it's fine. I'm happy with it. It's okay. But I appreciate. I don't think that was ever really a thing before. Autumn decor, you know, the pumpkin wreaths and pumpkin spice candles, is that what you call them? But I'm fine. I'm going to turn into one of those people and I'm fine with it. I've accepted it. Anyway, lots more important stuff to get through this morning. We will be discussing the decision to axe winter fuel payments. The debate is over. Yeah, it's happening. How will it affect you? Are you concerned? Also on the programme, the statue of Queen Elizabeth II, Antrim Castle Gardens. Now, I have not seen it, so I couldn't possibly judge. I have seen the pictures. I'm interested to hear what you make of it. Is it really that bad? Do you quite like it, maybe? I don't know. 0-30-30-80-55-55. We'll also squeeze in the Kamala Harris and Donald Trump debate, which took place last night. If you did see it, love to know your thoughts. But first this morning, is it time for people living in the most expensive properties in Northern Ireland to be paying more on their rates? Now, the amount that people pay depends on the value of their house, but there is a cap. That cap is £400,000. So that essentially means that any homes in more affluent areas, perhaps like in North Down, they pay exactly the same rates as much more modest homes elsewhere. Now, this morning, we can reveal 8,000 domestic properties qualify for the relief, costing the public purse £11 million currently. And the Finance Minister, Caoimhe Archibald, has now confirmed that she is planning to change rates, which could see some households and businesses paying more. She says she wants to build a progressive rate system which grows the tax base. And I suppose the key word there is progressive. That means contributing on your ability to pay. So are Stormont ministers finally accepting that tough decisions have to be taken to raise more money for our struggling public services? Just take a listen to this warning shot from the Sinn Féin minister to her executive colleagues on the consequences of overspending their budgets.
We know there will be further Barnett consequentials this year because of allocations in England, but we will only get full certainty on our share towards the end of the year. I am not willing to delay until then and see services deteriorate further while we wait. So I will bring proposals to the Executive to increase departmental budgets by our latest assessment of what our Barnet share will be for the rest of the year. It is expected that this will allow the allocation of around £500 million. While this will fall short of the overcommitment departments are currently reporting, it will go a significant way towards addressing the pressures. But all ministers will have to play their part by living within their budget once this funding is provided. I have a lot to get through, so. Not doing so would have grave consequences for future funding. Any overspend would come off next year's budget, and even more concerningly, the Treasury has been explicit that not living within budget would result in the Executive having to repay the £559 million that Treasury had agreed to write off.
Well, let's speak to the BBC's economic and business editor, John Campbell. Good morning, John.
Morning.
Some tough talk there, as Keeva Archibald says. She's got a lot to get through, doesn't she?
Yeah, so I suppose there's two things which really she announced yesterday. One was to give us this direction of travel and what's going to happen with rates. And it's the clearest indication yet that change is coming and that some people and probably businesses are going to be expected to pay more. And then the second thing she was talking about yesterday was the pressure on the public finances this year and saying that there are almost £800 million of pressures in instalment departments. That means that as the departments look at what they would like to spend, what they think needs to be spent, they are £800 million short compared to what is in the budget. Keeva Archibald was saying, well, throughout the course of this financial year, we can expect to maybe get another £500 million from Westminster through what are known as Barnet consequentials. Some of that will come via October's budget, but that still leaves pressures of £300 million. So effectively, she was saying to ministers, her ministerial colleagues, listen, you're going to need to cut your cloth. You're going to have to make your budget work because we cannot overspend, because if we do overspend, then that will bring back into play the previous overspend, which we had been forgiven, and the Treasury have made it clear, if you bust your budget again, you're going to be on the hook for more than £500,000, which we say we're going to write off.
A lot of figures involved here, and when we listen to any discussions that we've had on this in the past, and financial black holes, and any money coming in from the UK government has always been kind of on the basis that the books have to be balanced here. They're certainly not at the minute. There is a huge financial black hole, but they have come up with some ideas to address this, including this cap on removing the cap on rates.
Well, I think we should need to be clear that anything that they do on rates won't make any difference to this year's budget because we're in the middle of the financial year. So the rate system, you would have to start it in the new financial year and there's more consultation to come. So any revenue raising, the thing you're doing around rates, is not going to make any real difference to that pressures that we're seeing at Stormont. This is something for the longer term. So rates relief is, or revenue raising is certainly in the mix. We know it is in the mix because Stormont, as when they came back and they got the financial package, they promised that they would raise more revenues. And whenever the First and Deputy First Minister and the Finance Minister go to Downing Street tomorrow, it's, you know, that's something I'm sure they will be asked about as well. Where are you on this? How much progress have you made in revenue raising? So yes, it's in the mix, but it's not going to make any difference to the financial position in this financial year.
And in terms of what they've said, as I say, so it won't actually have any impact now. So why are they? Is that all this is then? Is this kind of just to take to Westminster to go, look, we're doing something here. We've got some ideas. We're going to balance the books. We promise.
Yeah, well, it's two things. One, they do need to do something on revenue raising. They've made that commitment to Westminster. It's a condition of the financial package which they got when they came back, and then. Secondly, there's a realism there that they practically are just going to need to try and find additional sources of revenue in the medium term if they're not going to get huge amounts of additional money from Westminster in future. And I think the other thing just to bear in mind here, although this financial package was agreed when Stormont came back, there is still an ongoing negotiation, which is about what's known as the overall fiscal framework. So that's the total suite of powers which Stormont have over the finances. And Stormont, for one, wants to get a further top up to what it will get in any spending which is allocated from Westminster. And there are also discussions there about potential devolution of some taxation powers, and also, I think, more importantly, giving Stormont more borrowing powers. So in order that Stormont could actually progress this broader fiscal framework debate, they need to show that they can honour the promises in terms of the fiscal package which actually accompanied the return of devolution.
And when she talks about, and as you say, whether this comes in this year, next year, doesn't matter really when, Keith Archibald talking about this progressive rate system, who's this likely to have an impact on? Because it's very difficult to kind of say, oh, it's middle-income earners, high-income earners, when we're talking about property.
No, I think it would be the richest people who pay more. There's no doubt about this. You know, but what we're talking about here largely is the people who own the 8,000 most expensive houses in Northern Ireland. So I don't expect that people will be going to the barricades to protect their interests necessarily. That is the main one, and I think Stormont has danced around this one for a while, this idea that basically no house is valued at more than £400,000 for the purpose of rates. So that means that fairly modest houses get charged the same rates as massive mansions. And if they were to abolish that cap altogether, it would only bring in about £11 million. I don't think they will abolish the cap altogether, because the Finance Minister has talked about the consultation which was previously launched by the Secretary of State was all about abolition. There was no nuance. So what they could do is just raise the cap to draw more people into paying higher rates. And you just look at their figures, and 65% of the properties which benefit from the cap and 74% of the costs are just in two council area, Belfast and Ards and North Down. And mm-hmm. I remember looking at this previously, and, you know, for example, Derry City and Strabane, there were literally, I think, about a handful of houses which currently benefit from the cap. So that's one thing which they're looking at. The other thing that they'll potentially look at, I think, in terms of domestic rates, is what's known as the early payment discount. So if you pay your rates all in one go, rather than paying it monthly, then you get a 4% discount. And there was rather more rate payers benefited from that relief. So about 160,000 people a year have the money, where they're able to have maybe a couple of grand, which they can just pay in one go to settle the rates for the year, and they get 4% off. If they remove the early payment discount, that would probably raise about another £8 million. So that is something which is in their sights. Those are the two main ones in terms of domestic. There's one other one, I think, in terms of domestic, which is known as the Landlord Allowance. Mm-hmm. And you have landlords, when they pay the rates on their properties that they rent out, they can get a 10% discount if the total rates bill is paid in full by the 30th of September in a year. That actually cost about £14 million last year, and it was awarded to landlords of about 210,000 properties. Although the thing we should note there is that includes the properties rented by the Housing Executive and the Housing Associations. So I think in one way, if you remove the Landlord Allowance, you would just have money being shuffled from one part of the public sector to the other, because the Housing Executive would be paying more, and that would give the Department of Finance a bit more money to play with, but then it would mean that the amount of money which the Housing Executive had to play with would have gone down a bit. So those are the kind of the three, I think, main ones which will be looked at in terms of households. But yeah, it is worth saying that the Finance Minister has basically just given us an idea of a direction of travel. There is no kind of policy yet, and she's going to bring forward proposals which she said will cover the short, long and medium term, and that will be within the next few weeks.
John Campbell, thank you very much. I want to speak now to Matthew Robinson from NI Conservatives. Morning, Matthew.
Good morning, Holly.
And also on the line, we have the financial journalist Paul Gosling. Good morning, Paul. Oh, we'll get back to Paul in just a moment.
I'm here.
Hello, are you there? Hello.
Yeah, I'm
hello.
Here. Hi.
Get yourself a cup of coffee there, Paul. Now, Matthew, I'll start with you. Tough decisions being talked about, finally. Are these the right answers? Is it going in the right direction as far as you're concerned?
We need to make tough decisions, but unfortunately, I think this is a draft programme for government that lacked any sort of ambition. This is just about getting us back to basics and back to basic governance. But of course, it's a lazy move to target hardworking families that already pay thousands in rates, and to try and squeeze them for more money to make up for the incompetence of Stormont over the last decade. I think it's morally bankrupt and incredibly lazy governance. I expect nothing less from a Sinn Féin finance minister. Yes, tough decisions need to be made, but for the initial knee-jerk reaction to squeeze hardworking taxpayers, hardworking families that already pay thousands in rates, many of which are in the North Down constituency, is lazy and, in my view, morally bankrupt.
Well, who should be squeezed then if it's not the people who earn more?
Well, I think we need to look at the amount of waste in Stormont. You had a previous UK government got down and made difficult decisions as they're related to things like legacy. The amount of money that Northern Ireland wastes obsessing on our past. We need to build
a lot of people
Ireland
feel that's very important.
We need to build a Northern Ireland for the future and invest in the future of Northern Ireland, not spend tens and hundreds of millions on lawyers and tribunals and commissions. That is how we invest in Northern Ireland for the future, not target hardworking families as it relates to property value. No one in Stormont will tell you that because there are no creative solutions to these problems. The last government tried to make those difficult decisions, but sadly many of these things are being rolled back and they're defaulting, whether it's Stormont parties or the new Labour government. Higher taxes, higher rates on hardworking families. It's sadly predictable. But I expect nothing less from the current Stormont executives.
Paul, what about that then? This is just targeting hardworking families and squeezing those. No ambition, Matthew says it's lazy.
I partially agree with what Matthew is saying, in the sense that I don't think that the Stormont executive has got to the nub of prioritising effectively. And it does need to decide what is most important for the people in Northern Ireland, what isn't. And actually what that means in particular is investing substantially more in our health service and also in our social care. And also, there is a reality that a lot of the things perhaps that were priorities in the past are lesser priorities now, so we do need to get to grips with that. But equally, we need to recognise that compared with people in England, people in Northern Ireland actually pay much less for their government. Council taxes on average in England are significantly higher than the rates.
And arguably, they're earning less.
Yeah, this is true, but I mean the scale of difference, and also we don't pay for water, which is separately charged in England. So you have to recognise that actually we're probably on balance underpaying for our services, and we do actually need to invest substantially. Now, we've had the Bengoa report 9 years ago, and the programme for government is not even recognising the need to cut health waiting lists. We've got this continuing problem, which isn't just a problem that we've got lots of people that are ill, we also mean that we've got lots of people that unable to work. And if we want to improve our productivity, if we want to get more people into work, we actually have to make sure they're not on health waiting lists and therefore unable to work.
So who needs to be paying then? If this policy to, for example, to remove the cap from those who are, let's face it, higher earners and have more expensive properties, who is it then?
Well, I mean, that is part of the solution, that we do actually need to make sure that we at least lift the cap on the most expensive properties paying rates. We also should stop allowing private sector landlords to have a discount which is not available to owner-occupiers and to tenants. But actually, that's just fiddling on the margins. We actually have to get to grips on a strategic way about what is most important within our society. And we also need to invest substantially in the capital infrastructure of Northern Ireland. So this isn't just about day-to-day spending. It's actually investing for the future. We've got a Northern Ireland water service that really is unable to deal with demands today. We can see that with Lough Neagh, but also it means that we can't build new social housing. It also means we can't build new accommodation for students in Derry. It also means that we have got problems in terms of the balancing of the economy just because we don't have the investment needed in our water supply and sewerage system. These are things that have to be resolved, but actually in the current budgets they can't be.
Matthew, just listening, you actually both agree on quite a lot, and particularly on what the priorities are. Do you think that Stormont has missed the priorities within what they've said so far, within these recommendations?
Yeah, I mean, I think, absolutely correct to mention Bengoa. I think it's the elephant in the room. You have a what was an excellent piece of work collecting dust for years and years and years. And I think that's an embarrassment and a disgrace. There's some really good solutions in there where healthcare, health and social care in Northern Ireland could function far more efficiently and deliver better value for money for taxpayers. I think capital investment is absolutely right. We've sadly got into this hole because there's effectively been little to no functional governance of Northern Ireland for so long. So this is a lot of this program for government is just getting back to basics. And while that may be a bit of a pessimistic outlook, that's just the, I think, the sad reality to where all the local storm-up parties have got us right now. Of course, I think long-term Northern Ireland needs to cut its cost. But why are we not talking more creatively about, we have devolved tools, for example, to cut corporation tax, something that then Prime Minister David Cameron introduced many years ago. I think we should be looking at innovative solutions to cut corporation tax in Northern Ireland and attract more foreign corporates to invest in Northern Ireland and make money that way. Why are we not talking creatively about that rather than such small-minded thinking about trying to target a handful of houses, asking for more money for the Treasury as if we're some sort of third world developing economy? Let's use the tools that we have. There's already a lot of American interest as it relates to the Windsor framework. Let's tap into this.
You're talking about a big picture here, and the big picture is that we need to be able to balance our own books. That's what it comes down to, and that's what is trying to. That's effectively what Keith Archibald is trying to do here, to set out some suggestions, proposals that will do that. And in terms of what you're talking about, it's all long term. What happens in the short term? What happens now?
Where is the finance minister's proposed cuts on countless, in my view, your wasted spending as it relates to obsessing over iPads? You asked many hardworking taxpayers across the board in Northern Ireland. They don't want to see tens of millions going into these tribunals and commissions, parades, flags, you name it. They want to invest in the future of their kids. They want better hospitals. They don't want to obsess on our past and our legacy.
So your answer then is just to stop all these tribunals. That's going to solve the problem.
Well, I think it's an absolute embarrassment that hardworking Northern Ireland taxpayers' money is wasted on
how much would that save?
You look at the amount that's been wasted already. You're talking about hundreds of millions. I mean, the UK government propose really sensible solutions that have both a compassionate but balanced view as it relates to legacy. And that's sadly all been the new Labour government, in collaboration with nearly all the Stormont parties, is looking to wash all that away, because Stormont parties don't want to make tough decisions on these things. So sadly, there's another opportunity burnt away. It's just small-minded thinking. And I haven't really heard anything that will properly get a hold of. And I think absolutely Bengoa is, if there was one thing that the Stormont executive could prioritize tomorrow, would be looking to implement nearly all of the Bengoa report's recommendations. Our healthcare system in Northern Ireland is an absolute embarrassment, and Stormont parties need to implement Bengoa in full without delay.
Okay, so Paul, what are your priorities?
I agree with what Matthew's saying about Bengoa, but what he's saying about legacy is absolute nonsense. We're not talking about the need to save a few tens of millions here and there. We're talking about a problem that's in the billions of pounds. Just to give you an example, Northern Ireland Water needs to spend around £5 billion over the next 10 years, and possibly more than that, in order to deal with the current crisis in terms of discharge, plus the need to create new water supply networks and sewerage networks to enable new social housing and private sector development to be built. So we're talking about a few tens of millions here and there in terms of legacy does not resolve the problem. We need every minister to go back to basics, to actually review all of their expenditure and decide what is no longer a priority. And there's some things which we would like to do that we can just no longer afford to do. But certainly, the fact that we've got a programme for government that it, So, for example, well, certainly the I think it's good that the finance minister is talking around the need to review the rates bills. But I do wonder, for example, whether we actually should have subsidised tuition fees to the extent that we've got, whether that is actually the priority that we need in the current environment. I do think that if you looked at the specific the economy minister's business plan, there's just so many objectives in there without any clear prioritization about what is the most important. Mm-hmm. I think the priority for the ministers is to prioritize their spending in their departments. And I think where I do agree with Matthew is that we've had ministers for many years that have taken easy decisions because they are scared of the electorate. And actually, we need ministers to make the tough decisions and to work collectively with other ministers. And that's where they failed over the years.
Yeah, but what about, you mentioned university degrees there, what about those from poorer backgrounds, children, the ability of children to access education?
Yeah, you're quite right. These things are difficult problems. But actually, as things stand, we've got a third of the students from Northern Ireland who can't get into universities because the lower tuition fees here mean that actually there's fewer student places than the demand. So you've got, topically, kids from poorer backgrounds are having to go to England to study, where the tuition fees are much higher and the living costs are much higher. So actually, it's penalising. The current policy is penalising a lot of people that are actually the least well able to afford to study elsewhere.
It's Holly Hamilton here in for Stephen until 10:30 today, talking about your rates bills, always a popular topic, after the finance minister confirmed that she is planning changes to rates, which could see some households and businesses pay more. Kiva Archibald says she wants to build a progressive rate system which grows the tax base. Let's speak to Jason. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning. Hi.
Sounds like some difficult decisions are about to be made.
Keith Archibald came out yesterday and quite clearly said that decisions are going to have to be made and they're going to have to live within their budget. But the point I'm making, when the plan for government came out, they all stood side by side the other day and said they were going to do this and do that, but not one of them has made a decision. Where are they going to cut? There's no policy in this plan, government, so they're not. It's actually a wish list. Who's going to make the decision about the rates? Who's going to make the decisions about the health service? They're going tomorrow to meet the Prime Minister, and you know what the Prime Minister's going to say automatically. He's going to have to make the decisions because it's a devolved matter. So are they going to make the decisions, and when are they going to make them?
And what will they be, Jason? That is the question.
Well, that's the question. Is it going to be rates? If it's going to be rates, that's going to hit businesses. That will have a knock-on effect on businesses, especially in this climate at the minute.
Jason, thanks for your call. I want to fit in a few more here while I can. John's on the line as well in Lisburn. Good morning, John.
Yeah, I think there needs to be accountability, and we need to examine just society. There's an entitlement culture here now.
What do you mean by entitlement?
Well, we're entitled to have X, Y, and Z, right? And it doesn't matter how we get X, Y, and Z. You're talking about rates there.
Mm.
In my council area, £1 million was spent on £700,000 plus on 12 statues in Hillsborough Park. That's just, there's no accountability whenever, I'll do it. And there's £300,000 spent on Christmas lights, which brought no business into Lisburn. And I know businesses that were, I talked to one young fella at a fish and chip shop, he says, I can't keep up with it. So if you're going to hammer the rates, you're going to destroy businesses. But the point I want to make is, we need to sort out the welfare. There's people walking about on welfare who get more when they're not working than if they're working. So we need to address the moral issues in society as well.
Another huge topic. John, thanks very much for your comments on that. It's interesting. James, listening to that in Temple Patrick. James, talking about priorities, not just where the money's coming from, but how it's being spent, I suppose, is an important thing to address.
I think there's a number of issues that the people there have said. First of all, on rates for private landlords, if you take away their discount, they're going to put up their rent. So that's going to hit the people who rent. So people don't think through the process of the decision. The other thing about pensioners, and a lot of pensioners own houses that have been their family homes. Some are affected by the WASP women pension debacle. And now we're saying to them, actually, you've got to pay more rates. But in fact, nothing is considered about their ability to pay. So then you start to think, well, how would we raise some money? So, for example, why do all of our civil servants get up to 30% of their salary paid as an employer's contribution to their pension? If you're on 40 grand a year as a civil servant, you're getting more paid into your pension than a pensioner gets on their old age pension. So, hang on a minute, that can't be right. We want to raise money. Well, hang on, let's look at cars. Let's have a higher MOT rate for the bigger the car. So if it's a 2 to 3 litre car, it might be double. If it's 3 to 4 litres, it might be triple. Why are we not looking at other innovative ways? A vacant land tax that's preventing development, where there's land where people have got planning permission, but they're not building. Let's tax them because they're stopping people building the houses we need or the schools or the development we need.
So for you, the priority is target the higher earners in everything that you've said. You know, that's the higher earners, the ones that own more property. And I suppose, as he's reflected upon, it has then a knock-on effect on the way down, doesn't it? It's a much bigger issue. Thank you very much for all your calls on this morning, 0303 80 55 55. And I'm sure this conversation will continue. 9:36, and we are going to be talking about the winter fuel payments, with millions of pensioners set to lose their payments this year after an attempt to block the change failed in Parliament yesterday. The vote was called by the Conservatives, who put forward a motion to block the government's plans to means test the benefits. Labour MPs say they will keep pressing the government to provide support for pensioners who struggle to cope with the cut to payments. 50 Labour MPs did not take part in yesterday's Commons vote. Downing Street says the measure is necessary to deal with the budget deficit. Now, just before I came on air this morning, I spoke to John McTiernan, the former political adviser to Tony Blair, and Asortia Eastwood, the Alliance MP. And I began by asking John if Sir Keir Starmer might come to regret this decision.
Look, I think it's a tough thing to have to do, and I think the government should have been making a stronger argument in favour of what they've been doing, if I'm honest. They're not doing this simply because the finances of the country are tight at the moment. They're doing it because the triple lock has increased the state pension so much since the winter fuel allowance was introduced that it's right to target it. You know, this year's uprating of the basic state pension is a couple of times larger, isn't it, than the total of the winter fuel allowance. The 14 years of the triple lock, another 5 to come under Labour. That's a long process of really improving pensioners' incomes, and it's time to target on the poorest pensioners.
So, Saoirse, listening to that, I mean, it's a conversation that we've had. There are difficult decisions to be made. And the government, as John says, they are arguing that pensioners are better off this winter, in fact, because of the state pension, because bills are falling, the warm homes discounts available. What about that argument? Pensioners are doing okay.
I don't think so, Holly. And, you know, I heard that yesterday, that argument being made from the Labour benches, and actually several ministers at the dispatch box had to admit themselves that actually those so-called mitigations are not going to be done in time. That's before you even get to the stage where pensioners are having to leaf through hundreds and hundreds of questions and forms that we all know some of them have issues with. So I'm not buying that. There are better ways of raising money. No one knows better than the people of Northern Ireland that unfunded and underfunded promises were made. We know the state that the Tories left the finances in, but this is not the way to go about this. And to sit there yesterday listening to people trying to come up with mealy-mouthed excuses as to why they're doing this, it just simply isn't good enough. I think for me, the big thing is, actually John said either on your show or a number of weeks ago on another show, people voted for change. Ironically, not one vote was cast for the Labour Party in Northern Ireland, but that's another story. But people voted for change. They voted for a directional change. They certainly did not vote for austerity Mark II. And that's what the big fear about this is. We can't continue on down that path.
Yeah, John, what about the people who voted for Labour who were sort of surprised by this decision? And you mentioned there just the communications issue here, how it was handled. You know, that there was sort of surprise when Rachel Reeves sort of delivered this almost out of the blue, I suppose, in July. Why? Why do you think it hasn't been explained better, what the reasoning is behind this? Why has it come as a surprise to so many people?
So I agree with Saoirse that people voted for change. I think the change that they voted for, and I wish Labour would say this louder, people voted to reduce inequality. People actually voted to reduce regional inequality so that, you know, bits of Northern Ireland shouldn't be unequal in the way that they are compared to each other or compared to the UK. The same across the UK, same across England, Scotland. People voted for that kind of change, a change of greater fairness in the future and the reduction in inequality, sustained reduction in inequality. That's why there's legislation being passed today by the Labour Party, or being put forward today by the Labour Party, about renters' rights. But that idea of tackling inequality, I think, should be at the core of how Labour talks. And Labour's talking a bit too much like accountants when they say we need to do this, we need to balance the books. It's a government. Governments make changes. And the big argument is, pensioner inequality has been reduced massively. Pensioner poverty reduced massively. The big, really big argument in the Labour Party is going to actually come in the budget around the two-child limit and child poverty. And I think if Labour made arguments around, the government made arguments where they prepared the ground, I think you're right to say, this wasn't prepared for, it was just dropped from out of the sky. If you're going to make an unpopular decision, and it must have been known inside the Labour Party, inside Number 10, inside Treasury, this would be challenged. You need to prepare the ground, you need to make an argument, and you shouldn't say a big boy did it and he ran away. The public finances are in a terrible situation, but people didn't vote, and I agree with Saoirse again, people didn't vote for better management of bad public finances. They voted for a transformation of public finances in order to transform public services.
Well, by that, Saoirse, because, as I say, difficult decisions had to be made. There had to be change. There had to be transformation. And that's what Sir Keir Starmer says he's doing. He's making these difficult decisions. And what is the alternative?
I think John makes a really interesting point in terms of, you know, the language of accountancy almost, of, you know, balancing the books, harken back almost to the Thatcheresque. I'm going to balance this, to quote in her words, as the housewife's budget. We know that's not how countries run in terms of finances. I'm not looking to get into an early morning debate on quantitativism, but, you know, they print the money. And we know that there are difficult choices to make. My God, nowhere more than Northern Ireland, as I said, have we felt the brunt of Tory austerity over not just one term, but 14 years. And we are, and I said on the first day of the House coming back, look, I want to work with the Prime Minister. I'm delighted to see a new government in. It actually sounds like they care about people. And I'm frustrated because this is not the way to have done it. I mean, I talked yesterday on the floor of the House about the lack of creativity. We could have an enhanced windfall tax on energy giants, which would create revenue. We could do a phased carbon tax that could help capture environmental costs. Ultimately, there are many more ways in which this could have been done. And John's right, you know, there is the budget to come. That ultimately will set the tone for everything. We will know then literally the colour of the money. And I think that's going to be really important because we need to understand that there does need to be investment in public services. And we're not going to be able to do that from a standing start. Yes, there is inequality. Yes, there is regional disparity. And actually, I've put down an early day motion on something that Alliance campaigned for strongly during the last election there, which was making sure that Northern Ireland gets a fair funding formula. We know, and actually the Fiscal Commission have admitted, that Northern Ireland is not funded at need. And the previous government ceded that themselves. And I have no doubt that this new government will also accept that. So for us, it's about making sure that we do our job, and I stand up in that chamber and sit on the green benches and make sure that I'm making the arguments that my constituents want to hear.
So, John, and this is, again, something that's been mentioned, that the idea that, surely there has to be an alternative, not just in how Rachel Reeves announced this, you know, the fact that this was the first thing, targeting pensioners, you know, why not target those on higher incomes? Why not, you know, it just seems like the first thing that you do as a new government to come in and target pensioners and the payments that help them get through the winter, it's a strange tactic.
One of the difficulties about British tax is actually the richest pay a lot of tax at the moment, and actually middle-income earners pay a lot of tax because of the, you know, bracket creep, because of the number of people who've been moved into the higher rate of tax by the freezing of allowances. You know, deputy head teachers, police sergeants, hostel matrons, they're all paying higher rates of tax. So if you want to raise tax, you mainly have to raise it off all the people who the tax comes off. So there's a big argument about tax and tax reform, I think, that we probably need to have over time. And Saoirse is right that we need to find new ways of raising revenue. We're going to have to discuss the road charging, because as people buy electric vehicles, people aren't buying fossil fuels, which is good for the climate. But it loses revenue for Treasury. So we've got to have some of those debates around that. I kind of feel that the government should probably have an emergency budget when it came in, done all these changes in the round, not done one off.
And should they have been clear in their manifesto?
The manifesto was pretty clear. The manifesto said, "We'll not raise taxes on working people. So therefore, no income tax, no VAT, no national insurance." So the taxes that have been promised not to rise are clear, which means the ones that which will rise are clear. And also, the government was not going to get into
the process of elimination. So are people supposed to read the manifesto and go, "Well, they didn't say they weren't going to raise this one. Well, they're not going to cut this one."
It becomes a kind of political game, doesn't it? You rule this out, rule that out, rule that out. Again, I think the Labour Party should have said, wait to our budget. We didn't do that. One thing we should have been saying, and that's picking up a thing on the thing about transformation that Saoirse said, why aren't we saying, as a government, the Labour Party is in government, saying, we'll use AI to identify these million missing pensioners? A million pensioners don't get pension credit. There's this lengthy form to fill in. Why would you need to fill that form in when councils know because of housing benefit and council tax benefit? GPs know who are paying. There's lots of ways to identify pensioners. Why can't we kind of shrink the haystack and go and find people and give them the money that they're not claiming? So I think there's a kind of, let's be innovative and transformative even when we have hard choices to make.
And what is going to happen within Labour? I mean, 52 Labour MPs didn't take part in this vote, John. That included seven ministers. There was one Labour MP, John Trickett, of course, who voted against it. And you know, and the wording even, you know, what he's sort of accusing the government of here within his own party, he says this could be a matter of life and death for his constituents. Labour are clearly divided over this, aren't they?
I think only 16 people didn't vote without authorisation. The thing is, this wasn't a big parliamentary debate on legislation.
Just so I'm clear, though, but when you talk about authorisation, there were people who were very, very public with their opinions who then did not vote. I think there were people who were perhaps looking for last-minute business meetings and reasons why they could legitimately not vote. That's that number 52.
With 412 MPs, 411 if you take away the speaker, the Labour Party has more than enough people to win majorities and letting other people off doing constituency duties, whatever reasons that they had to wait. You know, I think one of the Northern Ireland ministers was actually in Northern Ireland or in meetings to do with Northern Ireland. There's all kinds of reasons not to be present. So the rebellion was probably angry, a private, and the fact that only one person voted with the Tories, because again, that's part of this issue. It was a Tory motion to attack the government. It wasn't a vote on the floor of the House that was to do with legislation. So I think there definitely is anger on the Labour benches that this is being made the emblem of the hard choices that Labour's making. And I don't think anybody wants, any Labour Party member or Labour MP wants to go to the next election going, vote Labour because we delivered on our promise to cut the winter fuel allowance. We showed how tough we were on public finances. People want to say, we were tough on the finances because that allowed us to lower interest rates, which helped businesses, helped households, also helped the government because it made borrowing cheaper, which meant we could invest. And that investment has come through in 3, 4, 5 years in London, but also in Derry and in Belfast. And it's come through and you can see the green shoots of growth. That's the argument people want to make. And I think it's difficult if the whole government is talking about hard choices. You know, things will get worse before they get better. The government needs to start talking about what does better look like and when will it come.
John McTiernan, thanks for your time on this morning. Saoirse, just before you go, and talking about hard choices, we got our first draft programme for government for many years this week, of course. Now, there are a lot of pledges, a lot of promises, But really, when you look at it, no targets, no explanations of how they're going to be funded. And now we've heard the finance minister revealing this, you know, £300 million black hole in our budget already. The programme for government insisting that their brave decisions are going to be needed, collaborative working, innovation, efficiency in the delivery of services. What are the Alliance Party's ideas to fund the 9 priorities set out in the programme for government?
Well, look, we went out and campaigned in the last election about a fair funding settlement for Northern Ireland, and that's absolutely crucial. So that's why I have put down an early day motion calling for exactly that. We need to see an acceptance from the government that actually they have not funded Northern Ireland at need. As I just said to you previously there a few minutes ago, that's not my political opinion. That's actually in a report from the Fiscal Commission. So we know that there is a regional disparity. Northern Ireland has borne the brunt of that. And we do need to transform our public services. Our people at the minute are not getting the services that they are entitled to and that they expect. And that is a problem for all of us and something that really pains many of us.
So how do we pay for it?
And that's why we need to get a fair funding settlement for Northern Ireland. We do need to do transformation, but we can't do transformation, Holly, from a standing start. And we need to invest in our public services, not only to save, but to make sure that the services are better. I hear that the First and Deputy First Minister are going to be in London tomorrow, meeting with the Chancellor or the Treasury. As I say, I've already put down that early day motion calling for that. And I am working all the time behind the scenes with government, with anybody at all who will work with me to make sure that Northern Ireland's voice is heard in this. Because, you know, you can't drink from an empty cup. Isn't that what they say? And, you know, we are being forced into a situation. Take the winter fuel, for example. We are being forced into a situation where we can't break parity on that because we literally do not have the money to do so. And it's not just around that. It's around other issues around public service that I say are not acceptable in terms of the level of public service provision. You've talked about the PFG there. There are many areas across Northern Ireland that we need to see positive change on. And this is where I get really frustrated because there is a new government and you and John have both discussed the size of their majority. They could literally come in with a completely fresh approach and say, this is what we're going to do. And so far, we've not had that. And that really, really needs to happen. So we're ready for the budget. Obviously, that's relevant to Northern Ireland because there will be budget, Barnett consequentials, sorry. There will be other bits and pieces of money that flow from that. And we need to make sure that we're having conversations ahead of that so that we can maximise what we can.
Any funding settlement, and previous government made that very clear, is very much dependent on the ability of Stormont to balance the books. And what was interesting, actually, in what John McTiernan was saying there, that the idea that whenever a party sets out its manifesto, it's almost important to look at what's missing, what's not there and what's not being said, which is why, I suppose, I'm putting pressure on you to reveal that. What exactly Alliance want to do to kind of make up these shortfalls? What are their priorities specifically? Because if there's nothing said, then look at Labour. They didn't mention the winter fuel payments and so they took it away. What would you take away? What would you add?
So what we went out and campaigned on in the last election a few weeks ago was the fair funding settlement and reform of the institutions. That's really important whenever we're talking about public finances because at the minute, we have suffered from a lack of government for the guts of 10 years, no matter what way you cut it. And that's also then meant that we have very frequently a one-year budget. You can't deliver services on a one-year budget. You can't invest in staff. You can't sit down and do a strategic plan, particularly in the community and voluntary sector, based on one-year budget. And that's something that we need to see changed. That is critical to get instability, not just in terms of forward planning and management of public money, but making sure that we never have a situation again where, being honest about it, Holly, not having a government for 10 years costs money and it costs opportunities. And we're dealing with the legacy of that on top of the legacy of austerity.
And when we talk about a legacy, it's going to come in the form of bills. There's going to be money. Money has to be paid back somehow. And just looking at some of the papers this morning, you know, the idea that the estimation of paramilitaries costing Northern Ireland's economy £750 million a year. That's almost as much as Stormont ministers are set to overspend, just on that alone. And Naomi Long, obviously your leader, she is the Justice Minister. There was only one line in the programme for government on police resources. What message is that to the Chief Constable?
And look, you know, police and injustice are right at the forefront of having safe communities. You've talked about that money being spent there. We know that there is an absolute and urgent need to look to address those issues, and that's exactly what Naomi has been doing in her role as Justice Minister. Whenever we look to our other department as well, in terms of agriculture, Lough Neagh, hugely important issue for many people that in my own constituency live around the shores of Lough Neagh, but also in terms of making sure that we are good stewards of the environment. And see, with Alliance, what you see is what you get. And
but
we promised people that we would prioritise those things,
anything.
And we have. And we've promised people that we'd prioritise those things, and we have. And for us, you've mentioned collaborative working. It is absolutely key to work collaboratively together. That's what we need to do. But I think the much more global and broader point, Holly, that I'm trying to make to you is that we need to see a fair funding package for Northern Ireland. I'm not certainly going out, and Alliance certainly isn't going out and saying that hard-pressed people are expected to pick up the shortfall here. That's just not acceptable. Does it mean that we don't have conversations in the future about how we transform public services, about how we do things? Of course it doesn't. But at this point in time, the main thing is making sure the people who are already crushed under the weight of various inequalities do not feel any more hardship. And it's our job of political leadership to make sure that we get it right for everybody.
Saoirse Eastwood, great to chat to you as always. Thank you for your time. Let's speak now to DUP MP Gregory Campbell. Morning, Gregory. So,
good morning, Holly.
The winter fuel payments, that will be cut. It's happened. It's gone. But things got pretty heated in the Commons yesterday.
Yes, it did. It was quite energetic. And obviously, people were deeply concerned about it. Some of the Labour benches, people on the benches were very uncomfortable. There were some visible signs of people grouping together to abstain. It was almost like the old days of, I think there was a nationalist MP many years ago who famously said he was coming over to abstain in person. So I think it was a bit like that. And I think there was extreme embarrassment on some of the Labour benches. And unfortunately, Sinn Féin didn't turn up. That's why I raised the point of order.
That wouldn't have come as a surprise to you.
No, it wouldn't. But, you know, whenever people talk about austerity and they say, look, the government needs to respond, they need to help hard-pressed constituents, all of which I am saying and my colleagues are saying. But if people are saying that and they have an opportunity to come up and actually do something about it rather than complain, they choose not to do it. And, you know, that is deeply unfortunate. And I'm sure some questions will be asked by their own constituents about that.
You have to sort of wonder, though, you were there and you did vote, obviously, against the winter cuts being cut. But
yes.
So the winter fuel payments being cut. But then when you think about it, the Communities Minister is Gordon Lyons, who is your DUP colleague, of course. He says that they didn't have a choice, but this is a devolved issue. So he did have a choice. He could have protected pensioners here.
Well, what he was talking about was, number one, it was announced without any consultation. And number two, the fact that he said about no choice, it meant that the government in London were effectively saying to him and to the executive, look, if you want to pay the winter fuel payment, then you find the money. And you do that within a matter of a few weeks. Because remember, this has only happened in the past few weeks. The winter fuel payment normally gets paid in the next few weeks. There was just simply no way any department or any minister could find the amount of money that would be required. And if they did try to find it, where else would they cut in order to find it? So this should have been a central government funding pot, which has always been the case in the past. And the government were simply passing the buck and saying, look, if you want to pay it, you find the money. That's what he meant by no alternative, because we didn't have a choice in the matter, given the lateness in the day and the fact of the scarceness of money in the wider pot.
And speaking of difficult decisions, the programme for government, which we have seen, the question I have for you, why did the DUP sign it when we don't really have an idea of specific targets? I mean, we're looking at things like waiting lists, and you talk about priorities and how this will happen. If you're signing it, surely you need to know that.
Well, you'll know how that the absence of a programme for government has been something that people have complained about, and rightly so. We've been pressing to try and get a programme for government, and we were pressing to try and get a budget from the Sinn Féin Finance Minister for some time. Thankfully, now we've got that. But unfortunately, because of the system we have, what is currently a four-party coalition, an enforced coalition, what you have to do, it always comes down to, well, if you want this, we want that, and you end up not getting everything that you want. And everyone has to buy into that process, because if they don't buy into that process, then you don't get a programme for government. It's merely a skeleton. We now need to get the meat put on the bones to try and deliver.
What will that meat look like?
In the best way possible. Well, that's what we need to see now over the next few weeks over the autumn period. The executive need now to get down to expenditure points to try and ensure they find more efficient ways of spending money before they start asking hard-pressed taxpayers to find okay. even more money.
Well, hopefully we'll have more than a skeleton by Halloween, Gregory Campbell. Thank you very much for your time on this morning. Good morning. You're listening to Holly Hamilton here for Stephen. I'm with you until 10:30 today. Now, I feel like there's been an awful lot of bad press about this, hasn't there? There's this poor statue of Queen Elizabeth II at Antrim Castle Gardens. It's quite a bit of fuss. Now, I said this earlier, I have not seen it in person, so it's very difficult for me to have any sort of opinion on that. I've seen the pictures. It's tricky. It's always tricky when there's a sculpture or a statue, because they never ever really, most of the time, I don't think they're ever that accurate. But the description of this one, hideous, looks nothing like her, should be taken down. One local councillor, Vera McWilliam, actually told the BBC, "We have to be honest, it doesn't resemble the Queen in any shape or form." Antrim and Newton Abbey Borough Council has now actually turned off their comments on its social media because of the backlash. Just have a listen to what these people had to say about it.
The statue is very nice. Yeah, it's good. It's nice.
Do you think it looks like the Queen?
Well, I wouldn't have noticed that it didn't, but obviously with the Facebook coverage, etc., and social media, now that I see it, yes, it probably isn't a true reflection of her.
I think definitely it should have been her just before she died, or a year or two before she died, to capture the whole meaning of who she was and what she represented.
Honestly, it doesn't seem like the Queen. As it is on her memory, I guess it is a good thing, but it doesn't look like her.
I don't think it's quite such a good resemblance of the Queen, but you can definitely tell it's her, and I think it fits really well into the gardens. But yeah, I wouldn't take it down.
I hope we got it for free. It's really bad. And the corgis look like they're on steroids. Not good. And I'm sure they're, you know, us ratepayers and the council, we've paid a lot of money for that there. And I would take it away. I don't think it justifies, and it doesn't do anything in memory of Her Majesty. So definitely I would remove it.
Well, Kathy was so outraged by this, she got in touch with the programme, and it's her words, hideous, looks nothing like her, should be taken down. Morning, Kathy.
Morning, Holly.
You are outraged by this. Now, you're originally from Northern Ireland, you live in England at the moment. Isn't that
yes.
bad, do you think?
Oh, Holly, for goodness sake. Oh, it's absolutely atrocious. I mean, I first saw it on Facebook, and I thought it was some sick joke, you know, was my first reaction. And I went on Google to find out, and oh my goodness, I thought, oh, this is for real. I couldn't believe it. It's absolutely hideous. It looks nothing like Her Majesty. It's absolutely awful. The corgis look awful. And putting her in Wellington boots, for goodness sake.
Wasn't that her preferred sort of outfit of choice most of the time? Wasn't she always out and about with the horses out in the countryside?
But wasn't she out and about in the public and always wore a hat and immaculately dressed and everything, you know? No.
Right. For those who haven't seen it, can you just describe it then? We're sort of throwing little hints at it. So, yeah, she's in wellies. What else?
Oh, my goodness. She's looking one way. The Duke's looking another way. The corgis look awful. Her dress, you know, what they've dressed her in and putting her in Wellington boots. No, and her face, the face is nothing like the late Majesty. Absolutely nothing like her. No.
So I'll give you that. But looking at the photos.
Have you seen the photos?
I've just seen the photo. That's all I've seen. I feel like, well, you kind of get who it is, the overall imagery.
Oh, really?
You wouldn't mix it up for anyone else. Particularly, I think it's the stance of the Duke, isn't it? He kind of has that very, the hands behind the back and the chin out. I don't know. I'm trying here, Kathy. I'm really trying. Somebody complimented the corgis. They thought they were the best thing about it.
Oh, they need to go to Specsavers. and as for the dignitaries, yeah, I think Neil Kelly said it was beautiful. My goodness me.
Oh, well, I feel like the mayor has to kind of give it a bit of a boost,
and the deputy mayor said it was down to personal taste. I think what he means by that, it's truly awful.
What do you think needs to happen then? What should be done?
Taken down.
Oh dear, really?
Yeah.
What would you say? Because there was an artist behind this who I'm sure worked very hard on it.
He ought to stick to his chest, whatever he does. No. No. Holly, look at the facial expression. Look at the face on that photo. Now, does it look like Her Late Majesty?
Well, it is. Yeah, the face is probably the most problematic part.
It really is.
A better word.
And putting her in Wellington boots, for goodness sake.
But yeah, she did love being in the countryside. That was how a lot of people saw her. I've got the close up here. Yeah, the face is definitely a problem. But she's wearing, you know, her little sort of the headscarf and the almost sort of barber jacket, waistcoat, which we did see her in quite a bit, didn't we? Was that her? Yeah.
That's when she's
got a handbag.
Land, you know, just roaming about in her own private way. No, it could have been more regal. It could have been more elegant. No.
Yeah, it is sort of feel. It's giving me Beatrix Potter. That's what I'm getting from it. Do you know what I mean? She looks sort of like a Beatrix Potter character. So you think it needs to be removed? And if you do have an opinion on this, and like I say, if you've been there, 0303 80 55 55. Someone here has said that it was a down to earth representation of the late Queen.
No, it wasn't. No. I mean, I've been speaking to friends over here, speaking to schoolmates yesterday evening. We have a social call once a fortnight, and they didn't even know about it until I mentioned it. And you know, when they looked at it, I mean, they were equally horrified.
It didn't resemble
the Queen at all. No, it needs to go.
Oh my goodness. So Stephen is here and has been listening to this. He's in Antrim. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, good morning, Holly.
So have you seen it? Have you seen it up close?
Yes, you know.
So?
up close and personal. I think that the overall effect, if you can appreciate what you'd already mentioned, Holly, which is that the statue is of the Queen as you might have seen her at, you know, Balmoral or any of the other states when she's out in a natural environment. She has essentially, you know, the body warmer on. She has the boots on and so on. It looks a little odd juxtaposed beside the Duke of Edinburgh statue. I think that where my wife and I were most disappointed was the lack of numbers present at the unveiling. The Lord Mayor wasn't there. Apparently he was on holiday, even though he was quoted in the Belfast Telegraph as commenting on it. Well, you know, it's little wonder that the people of the borough feel that they should be able to express a view when so few people were actually there at the unveiling of what I believe was a very expensive piece of work.
Yeah, maybe they just wanted a kind of a soft launch as such for it, you know, to let it bed in a little bit in case it was received badly. Trying to be very careful.
Well, isn't this, you see, part of the problem, given your earlier part of the programme, Holly, when we're talking about a programme for government, that people hide when they think that there's going to be a controversy? They actually don't want, you know, to go on record or to actually have to account for themselves. This is really getting to the fundamentals of the gap between our public representation and the people. But the statue itself, I wouldn't have given it a second glance as a real piece of artwork, because I do agree with some people who think that it really doesn't look representative of the Queen. Although the context, I think, suits a place like a garden, although I think elsewhere in the castle grounds might have been more appropriate, maybe under one of the trees, where the squirrels and so on are.
Yeah, she's sort of wandering around a flower bed at the minute. And, you know, I think actually, Stephen, you've hit the nail on the head for me as to what maybe the issue is. And it is because, yes, the Queen was much more comfortable in this sort of attire, and it's how we were accustomed to seeing her in imagery around Balmoral. But it's the fact that the Duke is suited and booted.
Well, you see, and from that point of view, you would have to question then the commission that was given to the artist, not putting the two individuals together to create something that was harmonious, which I think has exacerbated the criticisms.
Yeah, it almost to me, it feels like the Queen was perhaps created, and then there was a sense that maybe she doesn't look quite like the Queen enough. Throw a corgi in there to give people a clue.
Well, they do look like corgis.
They do, and then maybe throw the Duke in there as well, just for good measure, just so we're absolutely certain who this is.
The Duke has been there for quite some time. The corgis do, I believe, appear to have been infused with steroids, but again, you know, you can only get so much out of a piece of work like this. No one's going to be perfectly happy with it. We're not talking about a Moor statue.
When you say the Duke's been there for quite some time, do you mean as in during their life, or is the Queen been a later addition and the Duke was brought in from somewhere else?
No, the Duke was there in the castle grounds. That statue was unveiled a number of years ago.
Oh, I see. Oh, so this is sort of like a Madame Tussauds thing, where they're just kind of moving them around and adding to it when necessary.
Well, I think with respect, we probably had to wait for the Queen's passing before putting her statue up there.
I hadn't realised. Okay, I thought this all came as a one. So he's being brought in from elsewhere. Pre-existing. Okay, that now makes sense.
Yeah.
And with what about the corgis? Did they come with?
Well, no, the corgis just appear. I doubt that the Duke of Edinburgh would have much to say, except get out of my way, to the corgis.
Oh dear. So I'm pretty sure it's going to stay, though, isn't it, Stephen? It's not going to go anywhere.
Well, look, I don't think, having spent the money and so on, I don't think anybody's going to make a move to remove it. I don't think it should be removed. To me, it's representative, but it's out of context beside the Duke of Edinburgh.
Okay. Cathy, are you okay with that? It's staying put. Do you think you could learn to love it?
No.
In a nutshell.
I understand what the gentleman's saying, but no.
I would suggest that anyone who doesn't want to see it just stays away from that part of the castle grounds. But on the other hand, we have to remember the service that Her Majesty gave to the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth over her years. And to me, I'm quite comfortable with the context. She was most comfortable with being with nature and being with animals and so on. So,
how many will remember her? Cathy, do let me know if you ever go to see it in person. I'm intrigued to get your reaction to that, will you?
Yeah, I'll definitely be over, and if it's still there, yeah, I'll definitely go and have a look.
Kathy, Stephen, thanks very much for your calls morning. Yeah, I enjoyed that. Let's see, Jim's on the line as well. Good morning, Jim.
Hello. Sorry, I've forgotten your name.
It's Holly. Nice to meet you, Jim.
Nice to meet you too, Holly.
So, Jim, I'm taking you're not phoning today about the statue. You haven't seen it, have you?
I haven't, but the next time I'm up, I'll definitely take a look.
You're going to have a wee look.
We're talking about South Eastwood complaining about Tory austerity.
Uh-huh, so that was earlier in the programme when we were talking about, well, essentially, what the plan for action is when it comes to Stormont in terms of maybe our rates are going to go up, you know, what is the plan? The devil will be in the detail. And we asked Saoirse Eastwood from the Alliance Party that a little earlier on. And what did you make of what she had to say?
Well, for a start, whenever Labour left government the last time before the Tory government came in, they handed back the things for government and they said there's a credit card but there's no money in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Saoirse Eastwood is very good at running out this clap-clap that was on in the Commons yesterday as well about austerity. It's a misnomer. They see Tory austerity in a black hole of 20 billion or 22 billion without any evidence.
So that's the issue, isn't it? So, as I say, the devil will be in the detail, and no one has any further information. And speaking even to Gregory Campbell of the DUP, and he said at the minute this programme for government is a skeleton. So hopefully we'll add some meat. In the meantime, John in Hollywood, good morning to you.
Good morning. Yeah, just on Saoirse Eastwood, I think she has absolutely nothing to offer. Basically, what you get from her is a word salad, you know. Alliance have no plan. They can't give any details. They just give you the usual, let's go and ask Westminster for more money. You know, the Labour government have just taken 9 million pensioners off Winterfield. Do they really think that they're going to give more money to Northern Ireland when there's nothing costed? There's no revenue raising. There's no plan. There's no plan for government. I mean, what Saoirse Eastwood said today is just complete nonsense.
What would you like somebody, anybody, any politician here to come out and say, what would you like to see within a plan? Because there will be difficult decisions. There's revenue to be raised. There's a huge financial black hole. How do you see that happening?
Well, could we be told what is the number one priority?
What is yours?
Well, I suppose mine would be the economy. And I would like to see more efficiency within the health service. You know, they come back to difficult decisions. Could they tell us one decision they're prepared to take? Could Saoirse Eastwood give us one decision? If Alliance were in power, you know, what would she do? What would they actually do?
Yeah.
Apart from going to ask for more money.
In terms of the difficult decisions, I think that's what people need to know. I think this discussion around the winter fuel payment has perhaps, it's ignited discussions along these lines because, let's face it, the money has to come from somewhere. And we said on the programme earlier, you know, this talk about the programme for government and whether or not this is removing the cap in terms of our rates bills. That wouldn't be nice for anybody, but is it inevitable?
But what about prescription charges? You know, what about efficiencies within Stormont, within the executive? Like, they're talking about $767 million they need, but 55% of that's gone back on salaries that they agreed. You know, if they want to go with the money there to fund it, why did they agree at the first place?
Yeah, so this is it. This is the you know, you talk about prescription charges. We've discussed water charges in the programme this morning. I suppose at this point it's up to what politician will come out and say, look, this is what has to happen and how the public will take it. And that's why we're here today. That's why we talk about it on the programme. You can have your say, 0303 80 55 55. Thank you, John. Let's speak finally to Gareth, who's in Kirkcudbright. Morning, Gareth.
Hello, Holly. I'm sure all of us are wishing the First Minister's well as they go over to see the Finance Minister tomorrow.
Meeting the Chancellor,
I beg your pardon, the Chancellor. Yes, we heard yesterday from our own Finance Minister, and reading between the lines, what she seemed to be saying was that we will not be allowed to have another overspend next year. And the previous 2 years overspend is going to be cleared either through negotiations on Thursday, which probably seems quite unlikely, or else we're going to have to honour the £113 million of revenue raising that was in the Hillsborough deal. But the ironic thing about it, Holly, is we've already been excused that by 1 year, i.e. we've already been excused £56.5 million because it's been put off until next year. Well, guess what? The Fuel Alliance, if Northern Ireland had kept that, including IT costs, it would have cost £52 million. So therefore, the money that we have already been let off this year would have more than covered the maintenance of the Winter Fuel Alliance for Northern Ireland. And a lot of us do think that Northern Ireland is a special case because it's not just about direct debits for gas. It's trying to get the best possible deal to put oil in our oil tanks. And that's why they should have pushed for a special case for Northern Ireland and said, we are actually going to make use of the same money that we were excused from this year to continue the Winter Fuel Alliance, Holly.
Gareth, as always, thank you for your call. I'd love to keep taking your calls, but there's one more issue that we're going to discuss on the programme this morning. You can't have missed this on the news. It's coming, the election in the United States. And last night we finally saw former President Donald Trump and Vice President Kamala Harris together on stage for the very first time. So for nearly 2 hours, they debated over issues including immigration, abortion access, and the ongoing wars in Gaza and Ukraine. And at one point during the debate, Kamala Harris criticised Trump for just wanting to impress autocrats.
If Donald Trump were president, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv right now. And understand what that would mean, because Putin's agenda is not just about Ukraine. Why don't you tell the 800,000 Polish Americans right here in Pennsylvania how quickly you would give up for the sake of favor and what you think is a friendship with what is known to be a dictator who would eat you for lunch.
And Trump also hit out at Harris and Joe Biden on immigration.
We have millions of people pouring into our country from prisons and jails, from mental institutions and insane asylums. They are taking over the towns. They're taking over buildings. They're going in violently. These are the people that Xi and Biden led into our country, and they're destroying our country.
And here's just another of the exchanges between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there. And this is what's happening in our country. And it's a shame.
You've heard.
You talk about extreme.
Well, there you go. Dr. Julie Norman, expert in American politics at the University College London, joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, I think quite simply, who won?
Well, I think regardless of one's political orientation, Kamala Harris won this debate. She came out ready. She had a few very strong zingers that put Trump on the back foot pretty early, and he just really struggled to get back in form. And I think that was just set the tone, and she kept it solid pretty much through the debate.
Yeah, there were certain, as you say, zingers that she made that seemed to really rattle Trump. In particular, you know, when she referred to his rallies, she commented on that people go, and she actually invited people to attend because she said they will get bored and leave. And that seemed to get him where it hurts.
That's exactly right. And for whatever reason, the rally size has always been a point of pride for Trump. And if anyone questions that, he does seem to get on the defensive. And so she clearly had that teed up. She kind of worked it in a question that was not at all related to that at all, but managed to get it in there. And I do think that got him a bit off kilter, and he just had trouble recovering, even in questions that should have been pretty softball questions for him.
And as we might expect from Donald Trump, he did come out to say that that she lost very badly, is the way he put it.
Of course. And obviously, both campaigns are going to put their spin on this. My guess is in the bigger Republican commentary, there will be a suggestion that the debate was more biased, that there was more fact-checking of Trump, et cetera, and simply that Harris was light on policy, which I think is a somewhat valid critique of both of them. This was much more about character than about policy in this debate. But I would say, you know, Trump, I don't think will lose many voters from this, but I think it might gain a few for Harris.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you. You know, in terms of how influential a debate like this will be, I mean, who is this targeting?
Yeah, it's such an important question, because I would say most voters at this point know who they're voting for. So I don't think we'll see much movement in the polls. And yet any movement in the polls right now matters so much because it is such a close race. So in this debate, I think Harris was really trying to hit those independent voters, those voters who were maybe begrudgingly going to vote for Trump but weren't really excited about it, and saying, look, there is an alternative here that you might not be thrilled about but might still be palatable compared to the other option.
And the other huge issue that came out last night, I don't know if issue is the right word, it might be for Donald Trump, Taylor Swift endorsing Kamala Harris.
Indeed, I would say that headline almost topped the debate headlines. And, you know, I think that's, you know, people have been waiting for that. She did endorse Biden back in 2020. And, you know, by her own statement, this was partly because an AI deepfake had shown her endorsing Trump a week or two ago. And it was kind of like, OK, we're going to set the record straight. But again, it's one of those things. I don't think it'll massively shift anything. Harris is already strong with younger, more female demographics, which is much of her fan base. But she is such a superstar, and anything can tip this election just a little bit.
Yeah, and it's fast approaching too. We're heading towards November very quickly, and very quickly. If you could give a prediction as to how it's going, because it does feel like something is changing.
Yeah, well, I would say Harris definitely has the momentum right now, but it's still a dead heat. In all the polls, they're all within the margin of error. And I will say it is coming soon. Early voting is starting later this month in some states.
Dr. Julie Norman, I'm sure we'll speak again. Thank you very much for your time on that. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all your comments, as always. Nolan@bbc.co.uk. I'll see you back here tomorrow at 9. Connor Phillips is here next.
Show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.